Welcome to the Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. Today, we are going to be talking about six different types of enzymes, what's the deal with our new format, and resting membrane potential.
All right, welcome to the Art of Med School, episode 17. Kind of a little weird recording right now without Jen, but, you know, we made the hard decision and we got to stick to it. So today we are going to talk first about the six types of enzymes. So our body has tons of processes that it goes through nonstop, constantly trying to, you know, make things and break things down and, you know, do all sorts of stuff to essentially maintain homeostasis. And that idea of homeostasis is really important. That's, you know, the idea that our body is trying to keep essentially the same state all the time. So, for instance, our pH level in our blood is 7.35 to 7.45. And part of a lot of our, or one of the functions of like our renal system and, you know, quite a few other things, our respiratory, a big way that our blood works is all about keeping that pH in homeostasis. So that, that takes a lot of work, right? And in fact, even the idea that duplicating DNA takes 35 hours to duplicate. So we have to have something to help speed all these things along, right? Otherwise, you know, we just wait for things to happen and it is kind of a killer, right? Not an actual killer, just kind of a time killer. So we need something to speed all these along, all these different processes along. And that comes in the form of enzymes. So they're essentially little proteins that are in our body that help speed up normal function. And what they specifically do is they lower the energy cost of reactions. So if you know, if we take molecule A, like a whole beaker of chemical A, and pour it into a beaker of chemical B, and we want them to combine, eventually those are all going to happen, or it's going to combine. As long as the energy doesn't cost too much, because in life and in nature and in the world, I mean, this is just kind of basic physics, is we don't want to spend a lot of energy ever. And so things will go in the direction of what takes the least amount of energy. We want to be in kind of that stable state. That's true about our chemicals as well as our bodies in that stable state. So enzymes lower the energy cost of reaction, so it lowers how much energy it takes for some sort of process to happen. And that means that it's going to happen more frequently because it doesn't cost our body as much energy to have these things happen. Now, there's tons of different enzymes doing quite a few different things, but we can categorize all of them into six types. And understanding these six types of enzymes is actually really helpful for understanding how enzymes work and also what they do. So the six types are, one, oxidoreductase, which oxidoreductase, what it does is it assists in oxidation and reduction. If you're not a chemistry person, totally cool. Essentially, oxidation reduction is moving electrons around. So you know what an electron is, right? You have the nucleus, which has the neutrons and the protons on the inside, and then on the outside is the negative bits, the electrons that float around in sort of a satellite-type fashion. And those are electrons. They carry a negative charge with them. And that negative charge, it's important to, or the reason we would want to move it around is because making something positive or negative will increase or decrease its attraction to other things, right? So one of the reasons that oil and water don't mix so well is because water has a positive side and a negative side, and oil doesn't really have that. So those things don't mix because the charges are wrong. So this helps us move our charges around. So an example equation would be if you have that A and you have that B, and that B has an extra set of electrons on it. So, an oxidoreductase would maybe help move the electrons from B to A. And an example of this is we actually oxidize ethanol, you know, like alcohol, to help process it. So that's the first one. The first one, oxidoreductase. The second one is transferase. Transferase does something pretty similar, but we're actually moving groups of molecules that have, you know, either carbon or nitrogen or phosphate, like a phosphorus group. So you might have A and BX that you're mixing together. That X is going to be a carbon group or a nitrogen group or a phosphate group then. And a transferase will come along and help move that group from B to A. Hopefully that's clear. An example of this would be coenzyme A transferase, which transfers thiol esters, which basically it's a group of chemicals, from one molecule to another, and that helps us make tryptophan. All right, so first was oxidoreductase, second was transferase, third was hydrolase. Hydrolase is pretty easy. Basically, it's just cleaving some chemical bonds. And what it does is it adds water. So it's a cleavage of bonds by addition of water. You would have, say, you have chemical A, and you pour some water in there, and you then have the enzyme that's a hydrolase type. It would take A and add H2O, but then it would give you, like, B and C. So you're actually making new molecules or new compounds from A by adding water in. So an example there is lipases. Lipases are used for the breakdown of lipids, so fats. By introducing water molecules, it helps to break them down and then we can absorb them better. So we had oxidoreductase, second was transferase, third was hydrolase, fourth is lyase. Lyase is another cleavage. So it's another thing that helps break apart bonds, and it breaks bonds that are between two carbons or between a carbon and a sulfur, and there's certain carbon and nitrogen bonds that it can break as well. So that formula would be, you know, chemical A, you introduce a lyase, and then it would give you B and C, and it would break it along one of those bonds that I mentioned. So between two carbons, it would break between a carbon and a sulfur, or possibly between a carbon and a nitrogen. Example here would be breaking down ATP, which is, you know, our body's main source of energy. It would break it down into CAMP and PPI, or pyrophosphate. CAMP is a cyclic adenomonophosphate. And it's CAMP. Actually, I might do a blog post on CAMP because it's a really important intracellular messenger. If you don't know what that means, all it means is that it's a really important chemical inside of cells to help cells know what to do. All right, so that was lyase. We had oxidoreductase, transferase, hydrolase, lyase, and now we have isomerase. Isomerase is sort of like the origami enzyme. It does what we call racemization of optical or geometric isomers. What does that mean? Oh, what does that mean? I can already think of Jen getting a blank look over her face on that one. So racemization, let's start with isomers. Isomers are basically the same chemical, but just organized in a little bit of a different way. So all the bonds are in the same order. All the molecules are in the same order. But what you have to remember is that chemicals, we always see them, you know, on a monitor or on a piece of paper, we always see them shown as a two-dimensional thing. But chemicals aren't. They're three-dimensional. They have depth to them, and they can be tall, and they can be short, and, you know, they can be rotated around. They're much more like sculptures than they are drawings, you know. So you might have a bunch of carbons in a row, and in one isomer, say you have four carbons in a row, in one isomer of it, at the second carbon, it might be bent up, you know. So think of taking two pieces of wire. They look exactly the same. They're made of the same thing, but bend one. Is it different? No. It's all the same stuff, but the shape is different, and that shape can be really important because it allows you to do different things, right? So an isomerase, that job or their job is to racemize or to change the shape. So not the compound itself or what it's made of. It doesn't break it down. It doesn't make new things. It doesn't rearrange it necessarily. It just more changes the shape of it. We call it's this idea of like left hand and right hand. Wow, I really stuttered there. Left hand, look at your left hand and your right hand. They're identical, but they're very different at the same time. Isomerase would turn your left hand and kind of flip it around so that it would match your right hand is essentially the idea. In biochemistry and organic chemistry, we refer to L and D, and which are, you can think of as left hand and right hand, because it all has to do with the order of dominance of kind of which way that chemical twists or is constructed. So L-alanine is a common amino acid, and an isomerase would turn L-alanine to D-alanine. So it's the same thing, just in sort of a different form. And the thing is that the L form, the left-handed form, is much more common, but a lot of our processes need the right-hand form. So an isomerase will take an L and make it a D so that we're able to use it. So that one's a little, it's if you're into chemistry, that one's not terribly hard. If you're not into chemistry, hopefully that'll make sense. If you look at some structures of chemicals, I think it'll be a lot more clear. So we have oxidoreductase, transferase, hydrolase, lyase. That was isomerase. And last, we have ligase. And ligase simply forms bonds between carbon and oxygens and sulfurs. So you have chemical A, you have chemical B. They have some carbons or oxygens or sulfurs in there. Pour in this enzyme, you're going to come out with AB. Not A and B, but AB as one chemical. So, for instance, DNA ligase is an enzyme that will go in and help repair DNA by making bonds between the different acids that create DNA itself. So enzymes are the one of the things that's really important about knowing this if you're a student is enzymes are sometimes assigned numbers based on the above categories, and they're in that order that we went over. So oxidoreductase is 1, 2 transferase, 3 hydrolase, 4 lyase, 5 isomerase, 6 ligase. And the mnemonic to remember these in order is Old Testament heroes lie in life. Old Testament heroes lie in life. So that's enzymes. Hopefully that all made sense. It's kind of a really interesting thing to see how this all starts to play out in the body.
Make sure you check us out on artofmedschool.com. We have a ton of more information, blog posts, any of our past episodes that you might have missed, as well as some really fun underwater photography that Mike has been working on. There's some cute photos of fish. So check us out on artofmedschool.com. Everybody. So here's the deal. When I was in St. Vincent, I was still on a tourist visa. Mike was able to be on a student visa because he's a student, but they just thought I was on vacation the whole time, which part of the time I was, but I was trying to be honest and I was trying to be good and I was trying to make money and contribute to society and all of those things. But when I was working my job, I was able to be working because they were able to hire me as a consultant. What needed to happen was, in order for me to stay there the entirety of the time, was they needed to apply for temporary resident status. That would have made my job pay for like a couple $1,000 in paperwork, and then I personally would have had to pay a couple $1,000 in paperwork, and this is U.S. thousands of dollars. And so at the end of the day, the money just wasn't going to work. So what I was going to need to do is go back to the United States once every calendar year. I thought, hey, a really easy, short period of time where I could make money back in the United States was the summer. Because in the theater world, summer stock theater is a really big, popular thing. You don't make a ton of money, but you make a lot more when you're comparing it against the Caribbean financial system. So I was going to get my meals paid for, my housing paid for, and then I was going to get a little bit of stipend. So I applied for the Black Hills Playhouse, and they accepted me with open arms. And so that's my plan. So moving to the United States, making some money so I can send it back. It's going to be fantastic. It's a wonderful organization, the only professional theater company in South Dakota, and it's in gorgeous Custer State Park. You should make it out there if you get the chance. So the other thing was, I didn't want to spend 20 months not adding to my resume any way, shape, or form. You know, being in your mid-30s, you're kind of in a delicate place career-wise, and you just don't want a big, giant chunk of time where you aren't doing anything. You want to look like you're still doing stuff. And in all honesty, I really like doing stuff. Doing something that feeds my soul a little bit more than showing people how to work in a restaurant a little bit better. So, what this means for you guys. Don't worry, we're still going to be putting out the podcast, we're still going to be doing stuff, but the format's going to change a little bit. That means I'll talk a little bit, Micah talks a little bit, I'll talk a little bit, Micah talks a little bit, and I close it up. I know. You don't get to listen to the witty banter and my hilarious medical puns. I know, it's sad for everyone, myself included, but we have worked something out for you guys. I'm going to be able to, we recorded some episodes in advance, and so we'll be able to put those in every so often. So you get that too. So bear with us during this transitional time, and I think you're going to like what we've got going on. Thanks. We launched our Patreon account. Please go check it out. You can find a link on our website or just look up Art of Med School on Patreon.com. This is a great way to support us as we work hard to make the most and best content possible. You can find more information on our homepage at artofmedschool.com. And every little bit helps. Thanks.
So we're going to do another sort of two-part series on, this time, potentials. So we know that, I know you know this, that when nerves send a signal to a cell, that cell then like does whatever it's being told to do, right? So maybe you're sending a skeletal muscle cell, like to your bicep, and then that cell knows to contract. Or you're sending it to, you know, your, let's say to your beta. Yeah, let's say your beta cells in your pancreas, and it knows to release insulin. But how does that actually know what to do? How does it know that that's what it's being told to do, or that it's getting a signal? How does that work? How do those signals actually get around? Well, it's all thanks to something that we call electrolytes. And I know everybody knows what electrolytes are because we all drink Gatorade. Electrolytes are essentially, they're ions that exist in the interstitial space. So the space between all the cells, around the cells, and they also exist inside of cells that allow for signals to move around. And this is kind of complicated, but not necessarily hard. So stick with me on this. It's also just really, really cool. So the activation of a cell is called the action potential. The action potential is when it's received the signal and it goes, you know, the chemicals happen and it goes, oh, okay, I need to do this. But to understand that, we first need to talk about resting membrane potential. So what does the cell look like before the signal comes? We're not talking about a specific type of cell or anything like that, because there's variances in all the different cells in the body. We're just going to talk about a generic idea of a cell, okay? So that, like, normal state of being that the cell is in, we're going to call that the resting membrane potential. So it hasn't received a signal, it's just hanging out. So resting membrane potential. Resting because it isn't doing anything. Membrane because it has to do with the cell membrane. and potential, because this has to do with the ability for a signal to go essentially back and forth. That think of it a potential like you would think electronic potential or chemical potential, kind of like that, because actually that's going to come in. So what are the things that make an ion want to go across a membrane? So we have these membranes. They're inside the cell. Some of them are inside the cell. Some of them are outside of the cell. And what we want to do is we want to move things either in or out in order for that signal to take place. So what's going to make those ions move back and forth? Well, first is the idea of diffusion. If you don't know what diffusion is, it's not terribly hard. Basically, ions or chemicals, they want to go from where there's a lot to where there's a little. So if you have more potassium on the inside of the cell and less potassium on the outside of the cell, because there's less potassium on the outside and there's more on the inside, potassium wants to move in that direction. Or say you have more sodium. Sodium is more on the outside of the cell and less on the inside of the cell. So because of diffusion, it wants to go from more to less. Sodium wants to go from outside of the cell to inside of the cell. And that's just simple diffusion. It wants to cross that barrier, that cell membrane, to where there's less. The second thing that helps to move things around is the electrical pull. And this is basically just simple magnetics, right? Or basic electricity. If you have a positive charge, things that are negatively charged get attracted to it. If you have a negative charge, things that are positively charged want to, you know, get attracted to it. So it's just the same idea as holding two magnets together or something like that, where the negative and the positive will go together, but you can't force the negative and the negative together. That's that same concept. So potassium has a positive charge, and the inside of the cell, we'll see, has a negative charge. So since those are different, that potassium has a natural pull to go inside of the cell. Now, hold on one second, you might be thinking. Micah, the previous example you used was that there's more potassium inside the cell than outside of the cell, so it wants to go out by diffusion. But now you're saying the inside of the cell is negatively charged and potassium is positively charged, so it wants to go inside of the cell. Which is it? It's both. I know, that sounds terrible, right? But the answer is it's both. Those two forces balance out to give that ion kind of an equilibrium. It might be more inside or it might be more outside, but those two forces are both acting at the same time, and it's going to make so more will be moving in because of diffusion, and some will be going, or sorry, potassium will be going out because of diffusion. It'll also be pulled back in because of the electrical pull, but at some point, it's going to reach a balance where those two forces aren't going to exert any more than from one to the other, you know. So that's that ion's equilibrium. Now, that equilibrium is totally different for each ion, okay? And it changes based on blood levels, because then you would have more on the outside, or you might have less than normal on the outside. It'll change, you know, the electrical balance based off of how much you have in your blood. But that's, you know, kind of individually set, that idea of diffusion. However, electrical is influenced by all of the other ions, because electrical is just straight electrical, right? The other things that's really important to take into consideration is the proteins in the cell membrane. You know, we have ion channels that open up to move ions from one side to another. Like, basically, it's the idea of permeability. If potassium wants to move out because of diffusion, but wants to go in because of the electrical pull, what's allowing it to actually move across the cell membrane? Can it just cross on its own? Some, yeah. Some ions. Are there pores or channels that will allow them out? Are there pumps? You know, how is it actually crossing? We have to take that into consideration when we're figuring out what this balance is. So it's very much influenced by the permeability of ions. So, for instance, all ions combined, potassium, sodium, calcium, chlorine, and all of these ions, give us a resting membrane potential of negative 70 millivolts. And so that's the charge inside of the cell, is negative 70. And each ion wants to drive that membrane potential at negative 70 towards its own equilibrium. Okay? So, if they're all, we already have this idea of this balance of diffusion and electrical forces. Now we're using this, now we have to balance all the different forces by all these different electrolytes, okay? So potassium is, there, its resting equilibrium is negative 90, and that exerts a tremendous amount of influence. Sodium, on the other hand, is positive 80. That's what sodium wants to be at, is positive 80, not negative 70. It's certainly not negative 90. But because potassium is has more influence, we're at negative 70. We're much closer to that negative 90 that is the potassium equilibrium. So why is it so much closer to potassium? Why does that make sense? It's because at rest, when the cell membrane isn't, or when the cell isn't doing anything and membrane is just being normal, the membrane is far more permeable to potassium than sodium. So that's why potassium has more influence. Since potassium has more influence, that resting membrane potential is much closer to negative 90 than where sodium would like to be at, which is positive 80. We also have a sodium-potassium pump that helps to keep concentration gradients where they're supposed to be. And this brings three sodium in for every two that it sends out. So it actually is pumping against the gradient, against the way that it wants to be, to help kind of balance things out and keep everything where it needs to be, so it's ready for a signal for it to do whatever job. And since it brings in more sodium, it brings in three sodium and only sends out two potassium, that means that we're building up sodium inside, or we're bringing in sodium. If you have done any renal stuff yet, you definitely know this. Water follows sodium, so it also helps bring water in. And this pump is actually really important for keeping the right amount of water inside of cells. It also brings in a little hydrogen each time, just a little extra fact. So also I want to point out that I said negative 90 for potassium, positive 80 for sodium. These numbers are pretty close, and I would like to add, though, that depending on the text that you look at, you're going to see slightly different. I've seen negative 80 for sodium. I've seen negative 85. For potassium. I've seen positive 80 for sodium. I've seen positive 65 for sodium. But all in all, even if you know your school or your text or your test or anything is using different numbers, as long as you have the concept, you're going to be okay. So now this concept, as far as potassium's amount of influence and sodium's amount of influence and wanting to drive the membrane potential towards its own equilibrium, that's going to be really, really important next time when we talk about action potentials.
There you have it. That was episode 17 of The Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. We talked about six different types of enzymes, what's the deal with our new format, and resting membrane potential. We all have some potential. Our theme music, Urbana Metronica Wuya Mix by Spinning Mercata, is copyright 2011, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. This show is not affiliated or endorsed in any way by St. James School of Medicine. Micah just goes there. The Art of Med School podcast is part of the Art of Med School Network. For more information, find us on the web at artofmedschool.com.